Chapter 33. Thursday, MadCon 2004. MadCon is a contraction of the ironically titled Mad Scientist Convention, so named because of the derision that heralded the inaugural event in 1931. The co-founder of MadCon was Mycroft Next, who attended every meeting in the Swindon Convention Centre that now bears his name, and eventually won the prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award in 1988. The event caters to those interested in outlandish scientific ideas, and despite being shunned by the conventional scientific community, MadCon continues to deliver top-class science to the world. Francine Grupper, On the Edges of Science. The Mycroft Next Convention Centre's main hall was huge, noisy, and filled with people. But despite this being MadCon, it was populated by not just the insane scientists working on the very edge of accepted rules of physics and mathematics, but also by journalists, industrialists, private equity firms, and conventional scientists in disguise, all eager to see what the deranged geniuses among the scientific community were up to. There were many trade stands, too, manned by both oddball and respected scientific foundations that wanted to help bring bizarre and seemingly impossible ideas to the marketplace. There was an hour to go before Tuesday's keynote speech, so I made my way slowly toward the stage at the far end of the convention centre. The Anti-Smite Strategic Defence Shield Corporation was here in force, hoping to sell the technology to other nations who might also have cause to attract the Lord's ire due to some misdemeanour of their own. I passed by the large Goliath stand, which was this year promoting the idea of homegrown donor organs with zippers for easy transplanting, or, for the more budget-conscious, externally worn organs that could be used on a timeshare basis. Beyond Goliath was someone peddling intelligent string to wrap up parcels unaided and for self-tying shoelaces. After that, there was a stand where a tech firm had designed a joke compression standard that would allow gags to be encoded digitally, stored and then played back with no loss of nuance, subtlety or humour, even after thousands of years. "Once we can successfully synthesise gags," said one of their reps once I had paused to see, "we'll have found another industry that the digital revolution can destroy for no reason other than it can. We're calling the compression standard JPEG." A few stands further on was a tech startup company hoping to solve all our energy problems by inducing power from the sun's magnetic field via a 60,000-mile tether being towed behind a space station anchored gravitationally at Lagrange 1. The power would then be transported to Earth by a high-powered laser with a transfer efficiency of 1.3%. Not impressive, but still powerful enough to cater to 3/5 of the Earth's power needs. "Would you like to take a leaflet?" asked an eager young man. I told him no thanks, and next walked to a group of tech companies that were adapting ancillary time technologies to assist modern living. I noted that AgeFast had a trade stand here, with one of their perfectly weathered Jaguar XK120s in pride of place. Next door to them, and still on the same theme, was a company marketing the Dilativator, a fridge that kept food fresh by simply slowing down time. "The interior of the storage unit will age only 2 seconds every week," explained the promoter. "A fresh steak will last 4 centuries, and at room temperature. Food storage problems are finally solved forever. And when our photon dilativator is perfected, we really mean forever." I hurried on, trying not to be distracted, and had almost reached the stage when I came across a stand that was manned by someone of more immediate interest, Mr. Chowdhury, Swindon's rep of the Asteroid Strike Likelihood Committee. I walked up and introduced myself to him, a tall man with a kindly manner and a soft voice that sounded like the E string on a double bass. "Tell me," I said, "how do you calculate the ultimate risk factor for events like HR-6984? "I have little to do with the actual calculation," admitted Mr. Chowdhury. "I simply feed in relevant details. Longevity projections of the Destiny Aware were of huge assistance. Since we have no one who lives past February of 2041, the destruction looks more and more likely. In fact, he added, we've just updated our forecast this morning. The likelihood of a fiery end has jumped from yesterday's 68% to 81%. Why? Several reasons. Pension applications have dropped off, and there has been a significant jump in the number of endowment policies to mature 1 year before the strike. It looked as if people were beginning to get worried after all, but then they usually did when the likelihood index rose. I suddenly had a thought. But surely, I ventured, as math was not my strong point, the fact that people are making provision for our end can't actually raise the possibility itself. Classical probability theory would exclude human expectation from the result, said Mr. Chowdhury in a quiet voice. But expectation-influenced probability theory postulates that the observer can and will affect the outcome of events purely by the weight of his own expectations. If enough people believe that HR-6984 will miss, then the event line will bend to ensure that it does. Similarly, if we all believe that we are going to die in a fiery cataclysmic event, we shall. I stared at him for a moment. The notion seemed, well, counterintuitive. I know the event line can be changed, I said, but I always thought our intervention was limited to things we could physically alter due to choice and free will. Not a chunk of rock the size of the Isle of Wight travelling through space at 42,000 miles per hour. Mr. Chowdhury thought for a moment. Take your brother Joffe and the Church of the Global Standard Deity as a case in point. For the past 1,000 years, the existence or non-existence of God has bobbled around the 32% mark, given the multitude faith dilution. Once all the major religions were joined together, the likelihood of his existence jumped to over 80%. And what happened? He revealed himself, I said in a quiet voice. Right, said Chowdhury, and once the atheists were on board, he began all this smiting. Without faith he is nothing, but with faith he is everything, and in this context everything means real, dangerous, vengeful, and unknowable. Is this proven? I asked. Not at all, replied Chowdhury. Expectation-influenced probability theory is right on the edge of accepted mathematics. You should get over to the stage if you want to hear your daughter talk. I thanked Mr. Chowdhury for his candour and walked away. If I had understood it correctly, the asteroid wouldn't hit if we didn't think it would. The trouble was, we thought very much that it would. To turn around the 81%, we needed something to change people's minds, like some sort of proof, or, failing that, doubt. I pushed these thoughts to the back of my mind and headed toward the stage, where I could see Landon standing at the side with Tuesday, chewing her nails. Most of the 500 seats had now been filled, and those unlucky enough to have been having a quick sandwich or a pee or something were standing at the back. You made it, Mum, said Tuesday, giving me a joyfully nervous hug. But where's Jenny? Dad said she'd be with you. I thought quickly. She's with Gran and Polly. They said they wouldn't be here. They changed their mind. I was just talking to Mr. Chowdhury about expectation-influenced probability theory. Does that make any sense to you? It should, she replied. I invented it. It's a sweet theory, because it's obligingly self-proving, and fits in nicely with the human psyche. It will prove itself correct, because we want it to. Why are you dressed like that? I got covered in... Actually, it doesn't matter. You look terrific. Ready? She pulled her face and crossed both fingers. She looked more like a schoolgirl, about to give her first flute solo, rather than the 26th finest mind on the planet about to address her peers.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, said the MC, who had just strode onto the stage, and welcome to day one of MadCon 2004.
There was a burst of applause, and the MC went on to welcome everyone to the conference, and then followed 5 minutes of boring stuff about where the fire exits were in case someone tried to blow something up or create a white hole or a small bang or something. And then he listed the high points of the conference,
such as tomorrow's demonstration of AA-size Duraspin kinetic batteries, a new form of copperless copper, and how earthquakes could be harnessed to prevent earthquakes. He started to ramble after this, and I lost interest. I was pondering over Jack Shit's curious behaviour regarding the copied Zivilkicks book, when the MC suddenly announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to call on Tuesday next." There was more applause, and Tuesday walked nervously onto the stage. "It is a great honour to be here," she began, "speaking at a conference that my great-uncle loved so much and gave so much energy toward. I'd like first to thank the staff of MadCon and the Board of Trustees for their generous help in..." I moved closer to Landon and grasped his hand, and he squeezed mine in return. Despite recent events, the smiting, Goliath, HR-6984, all I could think of was how much I loved my children and how proud I was. I like to think I'm pretty resilient, but listening to Tuesday talk, I felt my eyes water and my chest tighten. I remembered what a small baby she had been, how she had walked late, talked early, of her first erector set at 2, her first long-chain polymer at 4, and of learning Latin at 5, so she could better understand the Principia Mathematica. I remembered her first day at nursery school, and how the teachers said how much they'd learned, her first patent application for an improved alphabet with only 18 letters, her going up to collect her doctorate in mathematics at age 8. But through all that, she had been our little girl, and despite her dazzling intellect, we had endeavoured to bring her up as normally as possible. And while I watched her fluff over her lines with the nervousness of a normal person, rather than the detached and mechanical tone of her contemporaries, we knew at least that we had succeeded in attempting to make her as human as she was brilliant. And with that, we trusted, given her an ability to see beyond the pure science and the application of knowledge, and to be able to make a distinction between what science could do and what it should do.
"Makes you proud, doesn't it?" whispered Landon.
We listened to the rest of her speech, but it had become increasingly technical, and by the end we could understand only one word in 17. But we were delighted to be on the list of people she thanked at the end, in particular for showing her the value of normality.
"That was really good,"
said Landon, as she came off the stage to thunderous applause. She hugged us both, then was whisked off to do a press conference, leaving us standing quite alone. We wouldn't be telling her to go to school any more. As far as we were concerned, our job was done. "Well," I said to Landon, "how are things with you?" He looked at the tattoo on my hand and said that he was fine, that Friday wouldn't be back until late, given our last trip in to see the man-child, and that we were, parentally, redundant. "I suppose that's what we should be striving for," I said. "Thanks for telling Tuesday I was bringing Jenny."
"What was I supposed to say?" replied Landon. "Tuesday wanted her to be here. Which reminds me, did you get into Image Inc. this morning? I forgot again."
"Me too, twice. Hang on," I added. "What's Gavin Watkins doing here?" I had seen him through the crowds, sitting quite alone at a small trade stand. We walked over. "Hello, Gavin," I said, using a conciliatory tone of voice.
"Oh," he said, glancing up dismissively. "It's you, the tart mother."
It wasn't a good start. "Okay," I said, "we need to talk. You don't want to be killed, and we don't want to have to visit Friday in prison for the next 3 decades. Do you want some tea?" He gave a resigned shrug.
"All right."